Hello there. Dan Delman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. I'm also bringing you the history of frozen meals today. In 1938, the Brooklyn-born entrepreneur Clarence Birdseye invented a machine for freezing packaged fish that would revolutionize the storage and preparation of food. Maxon Food Systems of Long Island used Birdseye's technology, the double belt freezer, to sell the first complete frozen dinners to airlines in the year 1945. But plans to offer those meals in supermarkets were canceled after the death of the company's founder. Ultimately, it was the Swanson Company that transformed how Americans ate dinner and lunch. And it all came about, as the story goes, because of Thanksgiving turkey. According to the most widely accepted account, a Swanson salesman named Jerry Thomas conceived the company's frozen dinners in the late 1953 year. And that's when he saw that the company had 260 tons of frozen turkey left over after Thanksgiving, sitting in 10 refrigerated railroad cars. What to do with this? The train's refrigeration worked only when the cars were moving. So Swanson had the train travel back and forth between its Nebraska headquarters and the East Coast until panicked executives could figure out what to do with all that turkey. Thomas had the idea to add another holiday staples such as cornbread stuffing and sweet potatoes, and to serve them alongside the bird in frozen partitioned aluminum trays that were designed to be heated in the oven. Betty Cronin, Swanson's bacteriologist, helped the meal succeed with her research into how to heat the meat and the vegetables at the same time while killing foodborne germs. The Swanson Company has offered different accounts of this history. Cronin has said that Gilbert and Clark Swanson, sons of company founder Carl Swanson, came up with the idea for the frozen meal on a tray, and Clark Swanson's heirs in turn have disputed Thomas's claim that he invented it. Well, whoever provided the spark, this new American convenience was a commercial triumph. In 1954, the first year of production, Swanson sold 10 million trays. Banquet Foods and Morton Frozen Foods soon bought out their own offerings and winning over more and more middle-class households across the country. Whereas Maxon had called its frozen airline meals straddle plates, Swanson introduced America to its TV dinner. Thomas claims to have invented the name at a time when the concept was guaranteed to be lucrative, as millions of white women entered the workforce in the early 1950s. Mom was no longer always at home to cook elaborate meals. But now the question of what to eat for dinner had a prepared answer. Some men wrote angry letters to the Swanson Company complaining about the loss of home-cooked meals. For many families, TV dinners were just the ticket. Pop them in the oven, and 25 minutes later, you could have a full supper while enjoying that new national pastime, television. In 1950, only 9% of U.S. households had television sets. But by 1955, the number had risen to more than 64%. And by 1960, to more than 87%. Swanson took full advantage of this trend with TV advertisements that depicted elegant, modern women serving these novel meals to their families or enjoying one themselves. And now we're going to take just a short break, and we'll be back soon to tell you more about frozen meals. And now back to frozen meals. By the 1970s, competition among the frozen food giants spurred some menu innovation, including such questionable options as Swanson's take on a Polynesian-style dinner, which doesn't resemble any meal you will see in Polynesia. Tastemakers, of course, sniffed, like the New York Times food critic, who observed in 1977 that TV dinner consumers had no taste. But perhaps that was never the main draw. In what other way can I get a single serving of turkey, a portion of dressing, potatoes and vegetable, and dessert for something like 69 cents, said a man from New Jersey. TV dinners had found another niche in dieters, people who were glad for the built-in portion control. The next big breakthrough came in 1986 with the Campbell Soup Company's invention of microwave safe trays. And these would cut the meal preparation to mere minutes. Yet the ultimate convenience food was now too convenient for some diners. As one columnist lamented, quote, "Progress is wonderful, but I will still miss those steaming, crinkly aluminum TV trays," unquote. With restaurants closed during COVID-19, Americans are once again snapping up frozen meals, spending nearly 50% more on them in April 2020 over April 2019. According to the American Frozen Food Institute, specialty stores like Williams-Sonoma now stock gourmet TV dinners. IPSA Provisions, a high-end frozen food company, which was launched last February in New York, specializes in artisanal frozen dishes for a civilized meal any night of the week. This is a slogan right out of the 1950s. Well, restaurants from Detroit to Colorado Springs to Los Angeles are offering frozen versions of their dishes for carryout now. And this is a practice that some experts predict will continue beyond the pandemic. To many Americans, the TV dinner tastes like nostalgia. To others, it still tastes like the future. And now we're going from TV dinners to the subject of denim jeans. In the spring of 1965, demonstrators in Camden, Alabama, took to the streets in a series of marches. They were demanding voting rights. And among the demonstrators were 7 or 8 out-of-state ministers, United Press International reported, adding that they wore the blue denim uniform of the civil rights movement over their clerical collars. Though most people today don't associate blue denim with the struggle for Black freedom, it played a significant role in the movement. For one thing, the historian Tanisha Ford has observed, the realities of activism, which could include hours of canvassing in rural areas, made it impractical to organize in one's Sunday best. But denim was also symbolic. Whether in trouser form, overalls, or skirts, it not only recalled the work clothes worn by African Americans during slavery and as sharecroppers, but it also suggested solidarity with contemporary blue-collar workers and even equality between the sexes, since men and women alike could wear it. To see how civil rights activists adapted denim, consider the photograph of Martin Luther King Jr. and Ralph Abernathy marching to protest segregation in Birmingham, Alabama. This was in 1963, and notably, they are wearing jeans. In America and beyond, people would embrace jeans to make defiant statements of their own. Scholars trace denim's roots to the 16th century Nîmes in the south of France and to Genoa in northwestern Italy. Many historians suspect that the word denim derives from serge de Nîmes, referring to the tough fabric that French mills were producing, and that jeans comes from the French word for Genoa, gêne. In the United States, slave workers in the 19th century clothed enslaved field workers in those hardy fabrics. And in the West, miners and other laborers started wearing jeans after a Nevada tailor named Jacob Davis, created pants using duck cloth, a denim-like canvas material, and purchased from the San Francisco businessman Levi Strauss. Davis produced some 200 pairs over the next 18 months, some in duck cloth and some in denim. And in 1873, the government granted a patent to Davis and Levi Strauss and Company for the copper riveted pants, which they sold in both blue denim and brown duck cloth. By the 1990s, Levi Strauss and Company had established its most enduring style of pants, Levi's 501 jeans. Real life cowboys wore denim, as did actors who played them. And after World War II, denim leapt out of the sagebrush and into the big city, as immortalized in the 1953 film The Wild One. This starred Marlon Brando, and he played a character named Johnny Strabler, the leader of a troublemaking motorcycle gang. And Brando wears blue jeans along with a black leather jacket and black leather boots. "Hey, Johnny, what are you rebelling against?" someone asks. And his reply was, "What do you got?" Well, let's take a short break. Be right back. Onward into the 1960s. Let's look at denim during that period. This is when denim came to symbolize a different kind of rebelliousness. Black activists donned jeans and overalls to show that racial caste and black poverty were problems worth addressing. It took Martin Luther King Jr.'s March on Washington to make jeans popular again. Civil rights activists were photographed wearing the poor sharecroppers' blue denim overalls. And this was to dramatize that how little had been accomplished since Reconstruction. White civil rights advocates followed. As the fashion writer Zoe Washington observed, youth activists, specifically members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, used denim as an equalizer between the sexes and an identifier between social classes. But denim has never belonged to just one political persuasion. When the country music star Merle Haggard criticized hippies in his conservative anthem, "Okie from Muskogee," you bet he was often wearing denim. President Ronald Reagan was frequently photographed in denim during his visits to the California ranch. He was the very picture of rugged individualism. And blue jeans would have to rank high on the list of U.S. cultural exports. In November 1978, Levi Strauss and Company began selling the first large-scale shipments of jeans beyond the Iron Curtain, where the previously hard-to-obtain trousers were markers of status and liberation. East Berliners eagerly lined up to snag them, and after the fall of the Berlin Wall, when Levi's and other American jeans became widely available in the USSR, many Soviets were gleeful. A man hasn't very much happy minutes in his life, said one Soviet citizen, but every happy moment remains in his memory for a long time when he wears jeans. The buying of Levi's 501 jeans is one of such moments in my life, he said. Levi's 501 jeans is one of such moments in my life, and I'm only 24, but while wearing your jeans, I feel myself like a 15-year-old. Well, back in the States, jeans kept pushing the limits. In the early 1990s, TLC, one of the best-selling girl groups of all time, barged into the boys' club of hip-hop and R&B wearing oversized jeans. These three cute little girls dressed like boys, in the words of Rosanda Chile Thomas, one of the group's members, inspired women across the country to mimic the group's style. And curiously, jeans have continued to make waves in Eastern Europe. In the run-up to the 2006 presidential elections in Belarus, activists marched in protest what they characterized as a sham vote in support of an autocratic government. After police had seized the opposition's flags at a pre-election rally, one protester tied a denim shirt to a stick, creating a makeshift flag and giving rise to the movement's eventual name, the Jean Revolution. The youth organization Zuber urged followers, quote, "Come out in the streets of your cities and towns in jeans. Let's show that we are many," unquote. The movement didn't topple the government, but it did illustrate that this everyday garment can still be revolutionary. I want to tell you about the 26 words that create the internet, how they are now under fire. Section 230 has become a political buzzword, and critics say that social media companies are too powerful in their flow of information. Well, back in 1996, when the World Wide Web was just beginning to revolutionize the ways humans could communicate, many of those helping to build the emerging industry were filled with a boundless sense of optimism. That same year, Congress passed the so-called 26 words that created the internet. Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which shaped a new legal landscape for the internet and its portals of speech and information. Section 230 granted emerging interactive services on the internet a general immunity from most speech-restricting civil codes. Now, 25 years later, optimism has turned into a general state of unease about the state of free speech online. And this year, critics from both sides of the aisle, in terms of the left and the right, have been calling for these 26 words to be repealed, or at least significantly changed. And they cite the growing power of social media giants like Facebook and Google and Twitter, whose algorithmic architectures have come to control the information that people see or don't see. Who is Mohammed bin Zayed? Well, he just happens to be the Arab world's most important man. As crown prince of the Emirate of Abu Dhabi and the de facto ruler of the United Arab Emirates, Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, known as MBZ, is one of the most powerful leaders in the Middle East. Jutting out from the southeastern edge of Saudi Arabia, the UAE is a tiny federation of city-states, home to 1 million people and 8 million foreign workers, 1 million citizens and 8 million foreign workers. But it sits in a strategically crucial spot opposite Iran on the Strait of Hormuz. And now we're going to have to leave you for today. Please tune in next time. Enjoy your company. Until next time, Dan Dillman is asking you to be safe. Take care. Wear your mask. Remember social distancing. It helps us all. Have a good day, my friends. And tune in to a little of this, a little of that, because I'll be waiting for you there. A good day to you all. Goodbye.